scotch or eating pork. He eased me off his knee. As I watched him fill his glass, I wondered how much time would pass before we talked again the way we just had. That night, playing cards in the kitchen, Hassan and I heard a roar like thunder and the rat-a-tat of gunfire. The shooting and the explosions lasted less than an hour, but they frightened us badly. They were foreign sounds to us then. The generation of Afghan children, whose ears would know nothing but the sounds of bombs and guns, wasn't yet born. Huddled in the dining room waiting for the sun to rise, none of us had any notion that a way of life had ended. As it turned out, they hadn't shot much of anything that night in 1973. But Kabul awoke the next morning to find that the monarchy was a thing of the past.
The Kite Runner by Khalid Husseini was read by Kulvin Degir. It was produced by Jane Marshall for Jane Marshall Productions. Tomorrow, the pair of friends bump into the neighbourhood bully, famous for his dreaded brass knuckles.
No husband should have an interest of £20,000 in his wife's death.
A story of villainy, love and deceit.
Count Fosco may be sweetness and light in company, but behind his door, I'm certain, he wields a rod of iron.
A story of a woman in white.
Someone has indeed been visiting your mother's grave. Someone has been cleaning the cross.
Wilkie Collins' gothic mystery.
No tears. Let him insist all he may. There will be tears nonetheless.
The Woman in White on BBC Radio 4 Extra begins this afternoon at 3.
The digital station on radio, TV and online. BBC Radio 4 Extra.
In his memoir, The Music Room, William Fiennes recalls his childhood and the castle where he grew up. He also reflects on the life of his elder brother, Richard. Now on 4 Extra, Dan Stevens reads part one.
Our house was almost 700 years old. A medieval beginning transformed in the 16th century into a Tudor stately home, a castle surrounded by a broad moat, with woods, farmland, a landscape park on the far side, and a gatehouse tower guarding the two-arched stone bridge, the island's only point of access and departure. Richard was the eldest, 11 years older than me, 18 months older than Martin and Susanna, the twins. My father's parents had died within 10 days of each other, not long before I was born, and my family had moved from their village house to the estate, passed down through my father's ancestors since the 14th century. I played in a room at the east end of the house, the moat immediately outside. On clear mornings, light bounced off the water through the windows, the white ceiling suddenly unstable with ripples and wind stir. The surface of the moat reproduced in sunlight overhead. Our new freezer had just been delivered, and I'd got the cardboard box to customise into a secret house, a hatch cut into one side. My father was at work, and my mother was showing a group of history students round the house. So Patsy was here to keep an eye on me and Richard. Patsy tried to interest Richard in a book, but he was restless, brooding, pacing the room. He noticed a pair of moorhens paddling close to the window and shouted at them, "Shoo!" as if they'd insulted him. And that eruption seemed to nudge the whole morning off its rails, because Rich stood there with both arms held out like a scarecrow's, his eyes half closed, lids fluttering, as if there was static electricity in his eyelashes that made them flicker in and out of each other. The spell lasted less than 20 seconds, and as he came through it, he lowered his arms to his sides and saw both of us looking intently at him. "What?" he said. Quartets, singers, harpsichordists and other musicians came to give charity concerts in the Great Hall. I grew used to such invasions. Film and TV crews moved in like desert caravans, grey production trucks inching through the gatehouse, the car park a camp of porter cabins. We opened the gift shop in the stables, and I sold Ian McKellen a postcard. I ran through the arch into the walled ladies' garden and saw Jane Seymour in a white Regency gown bend to sniff a rose. I was 5 when Morecambe and Wise came to shoot their Christmas show, and I'd been in bed with flu all week. But my mother carried me downstairs so I could see the great hall garbed in vaudeville finery. Eric Morecambe walking over to greet me, adjusting his spectacles and barking, "Hello, are you married?" For my parents, the film crew days were a mixed blessing. The house needed the money, but they watched anxiously as strangers lugged sharp-cornered gear through medieval doorways and leaned spiky lighting rigs against Tudor panelling. Dad haunts the sets like the house's guardian spirit, vigilant for carelessness. He's up at dawn to turn the alarm off and slide the bolts on the oak outer door. At night, he or my mother go round the house checking the doors and windows, turning lights off. They call it shutting the house up, a daily task with its own ceremonial rhythm, an established itinerary followed from one room to another. The remote, formal spaces of the house are eerie in the dark. I'm used to the 10 or 15 minutes each evening when either my mother or father disappears. They open the door in the music room and step into historical dark. The minutes stretch out in our lamplit domestic realm while my father goes off into that elsewhere. At last, the door by the piano clicks open and he joins us again in the kitchen. Richard had had an ear infection when he was 2 and a half. At night, provoked by high fever, he'd started to convulse. Doctors told my parents these febrile convulsions weren't uncommon among children, and that in most cases they passed without further complications. But at 3, he'd begun to have tonic-clonic seizures, in which he lost consciousness and fell, his whole body stiffening in the tonic phase, before the clonic phase of uncontrolled spasmodic jerking. A teacher rang to say he'd had a bad attack, different from the others. This time, when the spasms dwindled, his body stiffened again, and then his limbs started to jerk once more, as if he'd passed from one seizure into another, without any period of recovery in between. An ambulance had taken him to hospital. He was in intensive care. Doctors used a term none of us had heard before, status epilepticus. I got my first fishing rod for Christmas when I was 5 and pressed wadges of white bread round hooks to dangle among minnows. I graduated to a longer rod and a selection of silver lures with red and black fish eyes and scale details painted on them. I walked round the moat again and again in search of pike. I imagined huge, ancient specimens flushed from secret depths, the moat's version of sharks, predators in its dark places. Perch, roach, and tench were just fish, but pike were touched with violence and death. The lure's weight carried the line wherever you wanted. The reel made a low clunk as the mechanism engaged. When you reeled in, the lure appeared again in brown-green shallows. Soon there was a rhythm to this, the sound of line frisking through the eyelets, the far plop of the lure, the dripping from the lure as you cast again. A rhythm that made the first strike even more of a surprise, the rod suddenly bending to the tension, tremulous concentric ripples spreading where the taut line entered the water, my hands alive with a struggling muscular weight, unmistakably pike. No skill involved, you just kept reeling in until the pike was threshing on the grass, head and tail thwacking the ground. I had no idea how to kill a pike. I carried the whole thing inside, pike dangling from the rod, and called out for my mother and father. No one answered, so I carried the fish upstairs and backed into the drawing room. Mum looked up from her desk and saw me with the fishing rod, the pike still twitching, fish water dripping off it onto the rug in front of the French windows. "I caught a pike," I said. The status epilepticus had scarred Richard's brain. A neurologist reported brain damage. Cerebral atrophy in the frontal lobes. The first institution was a red brick Victorian hospital, which I saw in glimpses when Mum took me to collect Rich for a weekend or holiday. Male nurses in two-piece white uniforms. Vast iron radiators in linoleum-floored corridors. Wire grills reinforcing the window glass. The dayroom TV tuned to the snooker. Later, he'd come home by train, and we'd pick him up from the station. Rich, last on the platform, his blue and yellow Leeds United holdalls stuffed to bursting, touch and go if the zip would hold. The return was a sunlit, ascendant time. Here was the Leeds United rug Dad called the prayer mat beside his bed, and the two carved herons on the windowsill, with their heads back and beaks pointing straight up like spires. We both loved herons. Rich stalked the moat in search of them. He took my father's binoculars and walked the banks until he glimpsed the bird's angular pose on the far side of the water. Once, as the car crossed the bridge, bringing him home again, he said he loved the heronity of the moat, and this new coinage fired something in him. He smiled and kept repeating it, savouring the word, turning it over. Heronity. 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 Those hours Rich spent watching herons were a state of grace, from which he returned restored and at peace. But often these visits home were fraught with difficulty. The seizures kept coming, and he was showing some of the behavioural problems associated with frontal lobe damage. Lack of insight and self-control. Failure to see other points of view. Sedated by anticonvulsants, he sleeps in till 2 o'clock. And comes downstairs in his dressing gown. He opens the fridge and eats in front of the TV, the circuits of a Grand Prix, a kind of mesmerism he can't shift his gaze from. My mother and father try to nudge him out of this stupor. They try to persuade him to wash or get dressed and go outside. But he keeps his eyes on the droning cars and says, "I'm busy," or "Watch your mouth," or "Don't speak till you're spoken to." The air prickling with menace. He picks up these expressions from the red brick Victorian asylum. He makes a fist and holds it to Dad's chin, posing the impact. Mum's left a heavy black cast iron frying pan on the left-hand hob, hottest of the two, and in a rush of terrible inspiration, Rich grabs it and holds the flat bottom against her cheek like a branding iron. She wears a headscarf on the school run next morning. To hide the burn. Our boat was a military green of hard, heavy plastic and catamaran design. One summer, the moat's infested by a pale green algae, the water invisible beneath a thick, gassy cover that's like a continuously effervescing eiderdown. Rich is here. Dad's come home with a sack of algicide, and the three of us push the boat out into this limbo medium that's neither land nor water. Rowing's exhausting. The blades coming up draped with weed, and Rich and I take turns while Dad sits at the back and opens up the bag of poison. I don't have to see my brother's face to know his tongue will be pushing inside his cheek while he bends his full concentration to the oars, and Dad comments like a coxswain. "That's right, Rich. Just a bit further. Let's get over to that corner. That's it." So piece by piece we work our way along. Dad using his hand to scoop through the sack and scatter gritty meal across the green. We're doing all this in silence now, and the task has devotional measure and progress. Dad's hand moving from side to side, with fingers open, as if he was sowing seed in a field, or scattering someone's ashes in a place they'd loved above all others. The castle was open to the public 3 afternoons a week from Easter to September. People spilled onto the front lawn and poured tea from clinky steel pots and ate scones, and sometimes Rich lingered among them, starting conversations, letting it slip that actually he lives here and, well, he probably won't have a cup of tea. He'll make himself a coffee in the kitchen, in his Leeds mug, and then he'll come out again holding the mug in both hands like a chalice, slurping coffee off the brim, saying, "That's right, I'm proud to be a Leeds supporter." Most of the time, Richard was away at the epilepsy centre, and the twins were away at boarding school. Left to my own devices, I often ended up in the music room. If I stood on the chair, I could open the lid of the upright piano and peer in at the strings. My mother's viola lay in the plush of its case with the lid open, like someone on display in a funeral home. Best of all was the small Whitner metronome Mum used to furnish a tempo, a cream-coloured plastic hutch with a wand like a clock hand on the front, a round fixed weight at the foot of the wand, and a second weight you could slide up and down to adjust the speed. Strange words, allegro, andante, adagio, printed alongside. The metronome fascinated me. I couldn't keep my hands off it. It seemed the time you set by the metronome was actual time, and that your life passed more slowly or quickly as you slid the weight up and down the scale, the music room a world that turned at whatever speed you judged appropriate. The tuning fork and metronome granted supernatural powers. The day's pitch and timekeeping were in my hands.
And tomorrow, Dan Stevens reads part two of The Music Room by William Fiennes. It was abridged by Viv Beebe, and the producer was Elizabeth Allard.
BBC Radio 4 Extra.
It's 3 o'clock and time for drama from our adaptation of a Wilkie Collins mystery. Then Mel is here with the 4 o'clock show. Today she hears from a man who can speak over 30 languages. And there's a new story, Jeremy Brown on Mars by Simon Cheshire. After that, June Whitfield is the guest of Dr. Evadne and Dame Hilda for a bit of a sing-song round the piano as we find ourselves at home with Hinge and Bracket at 5 o'clock. All this week, we're bringing you one of the classic Victorian Gothic novels. A meeting with a strange woman dressed in white kindles a mystery for a master of drawing, Walter Hartwright.
Once again, I am at Limeridge. I have gathered some flowers from the garden and have brought them to the churchyard. I stand here in the bewitching twilight, and I almost persuade myself that I can see that poor, unfortunate woman kissing the marble cross and beating upon it with her hands. What an extraordinary chain of events has brought me here, and how it has transformed my life. The story I tell is one of mystery, villainy, and daring. It is a story of love, a story of deceit, a true story of the woman in white.
The Woman in White by Wilkie Collins. Dramatised for radio in 4 episodes by Martin Wade. With Juliet Aubrey as Marion Halcom, Toby Stevens as Walter Hartwright, Emily Bruni as Laura Fairley, Edward Petherbridge as Mr. Fairley, and Jeremy Clyde as Sir Percival. Episode 1.
The tale begins, I suppose, with my Italian friend, Professor Pesca. He had left his mother country for political reasons, the nature of which he preferred not to reveal, and had settled in England. We met by way of our work. He was a teacher of Italian. I taught drawing. One day, in 1849, at Brighton, he unwittingly set the adventure in motion.
Oh, this water is freezing.
Yes, but a cold dip is very beneficial for one, I'm told, if you can survive it. You can swim, can't you, Pesca?
Of course I can swim.
Well, the unpleasant experiences of this world are best met with courage and determination. Now, Pesca, I shall race you to the boat, the little blue one. Pesca? Pesca! Oh, my God!
My good, dear chap,
You know, of course, that I can never repay you.
I don't wish you to repay me.
I will always be in your debt. And whatever I do now, you cannot properly be rewarded. Let me tell you, nonetheless, of a small thank you that I have arranged. I have obtained for you the prospect of 4 months' employment. More, perhaps.
Oh, yes? Where?
In Cumberland. Limeridge House is the place. Your employer is certain Mr. Frederick Fairley. 4 guineas to instruct 2 young ladies in the art of sketching and watercolors. It will all be perfection.
I sent off my particulars to Mr. Frederick Fairley of Limeridge House, along with a testimonial or two. Within a week I had received a letter advising me that Mr. Fairley had accepted my services and that I must start for Cumberland immediately. My last evening before departure I spent with my mother and my sister in Hampstead. We said our fond farewells, and then I walked back.